And you're gone too far, 'cause you know it don't matter anyway. You can rely on the old man's money. You can rely on the old man's money. It's a bitch, girl, but it's gone too far, 'cause you know it don't matter anyway. Say money, money won't get you too far, get you too far.
Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. We are here until 4 a.m., and then we'll head over to the Bradley Place, to the TV side of WGN, get an hour's worth of news and info from them, and then the great Bob Surratt will have your morning drive at 5. We are here 24/7. To keep you informed, to keep you company, and to get you through this. And we will get through this together. But just remember, WGN is here all the time for you. 312-981-7200 is the number. Every Monday morning, I have my two friends, Eric Childress and Steve Procopi, on to review the new movies and to talk about other stuff as well. And it is that time. So let's say hello to Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Steve. Hi, Steve.
Hey there.
So, how you guys holding up, Eric? How you doing?
I'm doing just fine. Our festival was supposed to happen next week.
Yeah.
So that's been sort of weighing on my mind last few days. Actually, thinking just like, you know, March seemed to take forever once this kind of started getting going, and April has gone by in a flash.
Yeah.
For me, and just thinking about what should have been next week, that's been bothering me a bit.
Yeah, well, how about you, Steve? How you holding up?
Good, except the days are all blending together now. Like, I was always really good about what was happening on what day or what did happen on a previous day, and now there's no weekends, really. It's just all kind of, I mean, it might be easier for you, Nick, just because you have somewhere to be every day at a certain time, but
yeah.
When you kind of don't, it's like, what day did I watch that movie again? Or what day did I get that phone call? Or when was the last time I talked to that? But like, it all kind of blends together, which is something I'm definitely not used to.
Yeah, I think that's happening. I think that's happening to a lot of people.
Yeah, I've heard as much, but I didn't really understand it until maybe this last week. Yeah,
yeah. It is helpful though that I'm pretty good about. I get a little confused even though I'm working, you know, 5 nights a week. But I still get a little confused because it's just such a weird time, you know. Because I mean, I basically, you know, I come here, I go home, that's it. That's it.
And yet, that's more than most of us are doing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So
that's a trip that most of us aren't taking. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, so we're here and we got some movies to talk about here.
Mm-hmm.
So Steve, what is the true history of the Kelly Gang?
Yeah, this is one of the first films I've seen in this period where I kind of really wish I had been able to see this on a bigger screen. In a lot of ways, the latest work from director Justin Kurzel, whose last two films were Macbeth and Assassin's Creed, so they were both with Michael Fassbender. It's sort of an equally brutal, male-centric companion piece to last year's The Nightingale. It takes place about 40 years after that film, but it's in the same Australian territory, Van Diemen's Land, which is now the island called the Island of Tasmania, and still the British military are still in the primary law enforcement, and Irish immigrants are treated like second-class citizens, and the film kind of centers on the legendary outlaw slash folk hero Ned Kelly, who's played by George MacKay from 1917, and his family and the circumstances that led to the creation of this sort of bloodthirsty revolution that he helped start and that disrupted the polite British society that kind of held his people down. We meet Ned as a young boy. His mother is actually played by Essie Davis from The Babadook, the mother from The Babadook. And she basically, after Ned's father is found dead under mysterious circumstances, she sends him off. She's sending him off with this guy who's sort of like his caretaker. It turns out she actually sells him to somebody who's played by Russell Crowe, who's like a sort of a notorious criminal in the area. And she basically wants this man to raise her son and treat him like teach him to be a man. She's kind of being harassed by this British sergeant who's played by Charlie Hunnam, and so when Ned finally comes back years later to his folks, his mother's homestead, he's like this lean, mean, bare knuckle boxing machine, and he eventually reunites with his mother and his now grown siblings, and most of whom have taken to committing crimes, and then like he befriends this sort of local British constable who's played by Nicholas Holt, and he also falls in love with a young woman played by Thomasin McKenzie from Jojo Rabbit. Turns out she's a prostitute with a child, but that sort of sets into motion a series of conflicts that pits Ned's Irish pride and his people's long history with sort of taking it from the British against the British, and before long the anarchist Kelly gang becomes sort of this source of terror and even death to their opponents. The film is really brutal and bloody. It's also just kind of sun-baked under the Australian sun. You can almost smell this movie, and I promise you the smell is not a good one. And it might be too abrasive and aggressive for some, but I think it's one of the few films, like I said, in this streaming-only sort of time that I really wish I'd been able to see on a big screen, because, man, it's a gorgeous-looking film. And if you can handle a little bit of brutality, I think you'll probably dig it. But it's available on most digital platforms and VOD right now.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now, yeah. Boy, what a great cast, too.
It's amazing, yeah. It's like kind of, and I mean, I think this film was supposed to come out around now anyway, so it's not that much of a pivot. But I'm fairly certain it would have played in theaters, so
yeah.
It would have been a good one to see that way.
This is not the first time they've made a movie about Ned Kelly.
Not the first, no, definitely not.
No,
but this one's interesting because there's a title card at the very beginning that says this: everything you're about to see is not true. And then the very next thing is some narration by Ned Kelly swearing to his young son in sort of a diary entry that everything he's about to write is true. So I think the filmmaker is sort of playing with this idea of film the legend, because it's a more interesting story,
right,
or at least a more cinematic story.
Right.
But I'm sure the truth is in there in pieces and places, but it's based on a novel about Ned Kelly,
yeah,
which is not the same as a biography in this case. So I think there's some fudging, but it actually makes it way more interesting and fun. So, but yeah, it's not a documentary, so don't treat it like that.
True History of the Kelly Gang, available on formats. Okay, guys, hold on a second,
mm-hmm.
And we'll get a couple more movies to talk about, and then we're going to get into best male and female performances ever, according to the opinions of Eric and Steve. It's WGN here, Nick DiGilio. Yeah. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Live in the Skyline studio here until 4 o'clock. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We got some classic Johnny Carson. You can watch the Johnny Carson show every night on Antenna TV. And we always play some comedy from there. And we're going to play some Jonathan Winters. and historic events that didn't actually happen. And much more. 312-981-7200. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi join me every Monday morning to talk about new movies and more. Eric is here.
Hello.
And Steve.
Hey.
All right, Eric, tell us about To the Stars.
Okay. Well, this is a film that actually is finally made available after premiering at the Sundance Film Festival in 2019, when we still had film festivals. But this one, it stars Kara Haywood, the movie is set in Oklahoma in the 1960s, and Kara Haywood plays kind of an introverted teenage girl, bullied by other girls and other people at school. Basically just tries to keep to herself and keep her nose clean and down. But then a new girl comes into town, played by Liana Liberato, and she's more of the classic rebellious, forms a friendship with her, and gets her to sort of open up a little bit and just kind of stand up for herself and, you know, recognize her strengths and things like that, while each of them deal with they're sort of their very sort of buttoned down family lives, particularly Liberato's family, as her father is played in a rare dramatic performance and a really good one by Tony Hale. This is a film that it was very easy at Sundance to sort of get enveloped, not just in the cast and the really good performances, doing sort of a mood piece from the 1960s, and it was very easy to get into it, particularly because of the really gorgeous cinematography, which was in black and white. Now, for some reason, and maybe Steve has more insight on this than I do, it's now been colorized. For some reason, and I have not seen the colored version of this film, and I'm wondering if that in any way sort of highlights some of the lightness of the film. That, you know, the film was not especially deep, but it was well acted, and like I said, it was just so gorgeous to look at that it was very easy to just sort of go along with the story. That's pretty familiar when you start hearing about what their hidden sins are and things like that. It's not too hard to guess exactly where this film is headed, but at the same time, you were just always sort of glued to the screen because it was just a beautiful thing to look at. Now that it's in color, I'm wondering if it's been diminished in any way. And Steve, I don't think you saw it at Sundance. Have you seen the new version?
Yes. Well, first of all, I just want to make sure people don't go crazy thinking that a black and white movie was colorized. This movie was shot in color, and they took the color out and made it black and white. That's usually the way most black and white films these days are done. But so I was not even aware that it originally played in black and white until right after I saw it. I don't think it really diminishes it at all, and so sometimes like the most quiet and unassuming films kind of pack the heaviest blow, and when it comes to, you know, messages about those in society who are deemed sort of outsiders or maybe even undesirables, who should be, you know, treasured and protected rather than sort of run out on a rail. But at the same time, there are other films that sort of tackle this subject that are sort of overwritten and overdirected, and I think To the Stars kind of falls in the middle a little bit. I really like this director, Martha Stevens. She co-directed a film a couple years ago called Land Ho that I really liked, and there isn't much in the way of story here, and certainly, as Eric alluded to, it's not particularly it's very predictable, a lot of what's going to happen, but that isn't necessarily a bad thing. The film is more of a character study of these two young women who are both sort of in this painful process of figuring out who they are and who they're willing to let people see that they are. There are times when the girls' stories are almost competing for our attention, as Kara Hayward's character is more just sort of going through the traumatic experience Liana's character is sort of going through this traumatic experience of suppressing her sort of same-sex urges to please her parents, and she's sort of secretly drawn to this woman who lives in the town who is also a transplant like she is, and clearly running away from something like her family is. But, you know, for all the elements of To the Stars that work really well, in particular the two lead performances, there are some things that just kind of skim the surface of what I think could have been something better. And some of the, especially the parental characters, I think are a little too stereotypical. They're either sort of kind or they're outright horrible, without a lot of middle ground. And but the period elements feel really authentic, and the sense of place really adds to the story being told. And even with its flaws, I think the movie feels really lived in, and it sets a tone for everything from this friendship to affection, attention, and even violence. So it's an easy film to like, even if it falls short of being something great.
Okay. All right. That's To the Stars. All right, Steve, tell us about Time Warp.
Oh, I love a good documentary about movies. Okay, so this is the first of a three-part documentary series on the history of some of the most famous cult films ever. And I realize calling something a famous cult film might be a bit of an oxymoron, but this is from director Danny Wolf. Time Warp is essentially, and this first part is called Volume 1, Midnight Madness, and it kind of encompasses films that don't quite fit into what the other two parts are going to be. The second part, which comes out in May, is going to be about horror and sci-fi, and Volume 3 is going to be about comedy and camp, and that comes out at the end of June. So, which is by no means to indicate that the films in Midnight Madness are disposable in a way, they just don't easily fit into those categories. The series is hosted in a little bit superfluously by Joe Dante, with a panel of people that include John Waters and Ileana Douglas and Kevin Pollak, and they're all just sort of sitting on director's chairs, and they introduce each new group of movies, but I don't really think they add much to what is on display here. I think Dante and Waters certainly add more in terms of just meaningful information to the conversation, but the meat of the film comes from these little short profiles of this handful of titles discussed by the people that made them and the people that starred in them. There's also film critics and historians and other filmmakers who are just fans of these enormously entertaining works, and they often sort of share the common thread of being box office failures that somehow caught on the midnight circuit long after their release. They kind of start out with Rocky Horror Picture Show and move on to like certain blaxploitation films, especially the ones from director Jack Hill and actress Pam Grier. You know, Pink Flamingos, Spinal Tap, Freaks, The Big Lebowski, Reefer Madness, Eraserhead. I mean, you could just go, it goes on and on. Assault on Precinct 13 and The Warriors is in here. So, and with nearly every film discussed, the filmmakers sort of offer a perspective on the making, not just the making of the movie, but more the path each film took to gaining a certain amount of cult recognition. As much as I enjoyed revisiting some of these films, that certainly occupy a place of honor on my media shelves, I wish the film had dug a little deeper and singled out a few lesser known films, but I mean, it's right there in the title. These are supposed to be the greatest cult films, and I'm assuming that by that they mean the greatest known cult films of all time. Still, I'm very eager to check out what the next two chapters have to offer, especially the one covering horror and science fiction. That's basically my gateway genres into cult movies. So I think younger filmgoers might get more out of it as sort of a jumping off point. It's hard to argue with any of the choices in this film that they choose to profile. And I think if a more seasoned film lover, it's a great way of sort of revisiting these works. And like I said, the first part's going now on demand, and then the second one's in May, and then the third one's in June.
Okay. Eric, what do you think?
Yeah, I liked it too. And the thing that's what I think makes these particular types of documentary special is that they're basically gateway drugs. In that, you know, guys like the three of us who have seen all of these movies and know, you know, most of the anecdotes about them, it's just kind of fun to hear other people speak with the same sort of love and passion that we have. But we know that someone who, you know, may be a lot younger than us have not a chance to experience some of these things and are going to be discovering these things the way that, say, if you watch something like Electric Boogaloo about the Cannon films or Night Quad Hollywood about Australia cinema, which I've each watched over the last week as well, you'll go back and start writing some of these titles down. And unlike, you know, like CNN had this whole special about the movies last summer, and they tried, you know, even though it was like 10 parts, they tried to get through so much material in that time that, you know, it seemed like only sometimes 90 seconds was devoted to certain movies. And this one, at least, they take their time a bit. They allow some breathing room to allow people in to talk about it and sometimes talk at length about certain aspects of them. I've seen two of the three episodes so far, and one of them, Nick, you get to hear Gary Busey talk all about Point Break.
Oh.
A lot.
Yeah. That's the first one, yeah.
To the point that Gary Busey doesn't even seem to recollect the actual plot of the movie, but desperately wants to work with Kathryn Bigelow again and thinks it's one of the greatest films ever made, which you wouldn't disagree with.
No.
But, you know, then there are things that we would agree with or wouldn't agree with either. I mean, Devil's Rejects is featured in part two of this. So there are things that we will quibble with. I still don't know what Kevin Pollak is doing on that panel yet. I don't think that's really been been made clear. He doesn't have a whole lot to offer. I wish it was just sort of Dante and Waters talking between the two of them. That's sort of the weaker part of the series. But when they allow it, they open it up and allow a lot of talking heads, and they got Jeff Bridges and John Turturro talking about Big Lebowski and stuff like that. A lot of that is, again, it's just crack for guys like us.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So that's Time Warp, the greatest cult films of all time. All right. Guys, hang on.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Eric and Steve are going to hang on, and we come back. We're going to talk about some of the best performances by actors and actresses. And Eric made a bunch of picks, and Steve made a bunch of picks. Best male performances, best female performances of all time are their personal favorites. 312-981-7200 is the phone number right here on WGN. Good morning, Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline studio here until 4 a.m. And my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday and it's a jokey time. We got some classic Jonathan Winters stuff from the Johnny Carson show. And we have 75 short jokes anyone can remember and historic events that actually didn't happen. and some knockoff brands. Generic food brands that are just ridiculous and hilarious. All that and more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi joined me. Nothing is being released into movie theaters, obviously, but we've reviewed some stuff that's now streaming that you can watch in the safety of your own home. And we also have other categories that we've been discussing, and we're going to talk about some of the best male and female performances of all time. Here's Eric.
Hello.
And Steve.
Hello.
We do have a caller here. It's Bill. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, what's up?
Good, I love your show.
Thank you.
First of all, I have a three-part question that is they're all tied together, okay? Part one is, did either of you see Bad Education last night? Number two, if so, what did you think of it? And number three, why was it released to HBO as opposed to theatrical? I don't quite understand that.
All right. Eric, you want to go first?
Yeah. I saw the movie actually at the Toronto Film Festival last year. That's where it premiered. HBO actually snatched up the rights to it to put on their platform. So that's the reason why it was put on HBO. It wasn't anything with the current situation. That it was always going to HBO after it was bought at Toronto. When I saw it, I had some... there are things about the movie that I like, and there were some things about the movie that I had some issues with. I was having one of those sort of bad festival days, so I was kind of anxious to revisit the movie again because I think Hugh Jackman is really good in the movie. There are elements of the movie that I thought could have been a little tighter and a little more fleshed out. Although, Nick, if you don't know what this movie is, I think we talked about it back then, but it's directed by Corey Finley, who did Thoroughbreds.
Right.
Yeah, so I think you will definitely want to check the movie out.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Steve, what about you?
I did not see it. I haven't recorded it. I haven't watched it.
Yeah, I haven't seen it.
I'm very much looking forward to it.
I actually grew up in Roslyn, Nick.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to that school.
All right. I have not seen the movie. So
yeah, it's really interesting. It's really interesting. And I have a unique perspective as someone who I went there years before this happened, but I have a unique perspective on it. But I enjoyed it. I found it interesting.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
There you go. Okay. Let's go to some of these great performances that we were talking about. Eric, why don't we start with you? Your list of the best male performances. You got Paul Newman, Nobody's Fool.
Yeah, I mean, this was the year 1994 where Tom Hanks had Forrest Gump going for him, and a lot of people thought that if that didn't happen, then Paul Newman would have won his second Oscar for this really wonderful movie with him and Melanie Griffith, Bruce Willis. An uncredited cameo, lengthy cameo in the movie. But it's a really solid drama about this old guy in town who's basically not been a great father, has not been a great anything, but he's sort of trying to, you know, gain back a little bit of his your trust and his family, you know, towards the, you know, the back end of his life. It's a really special performance by Paul Newman. Very funny movie, and really heartfelt.
It's a great movie. I love that movie, and it's a great performance by Paul Newman. Okay, best male performance is for Steve. You got De Niro in Raging Bull.
Yeah, I hate to start with something so obvious, but yeah, it might be my all-time favorite performance by any actor, so why the heck not? I mean, it's not just because of this, like, physical transformation stuff. It's like, it's just, like, searing, and there's, like, animalistic violence, but De Niro as Jake LaMotta is, like, there's something you see the capacity for violence in him, but you also kind of get why so many people find him charming. And that was sort of it for me, was that personality transformation that he could make on a dime, and he could go from charming to threatening just like that. And that's the thing that got me about the performance. And then, like, you know, he's just so, and the scenes between him and, as sort of incredible as the scenes between him and Kathy Moriarty are, the scenes between him and Pesci,
yeah,
are so good, and they kind of establish a relationship that, it, you know, carried into last year. So, I'd love the film, but I particularly think that performance is like one in a million.
Yeah, yeah. Male performance on your side, Eric, Jude Law, Road to Perdition?
Yeah, I mean, a local, you know, Chicago production that, you know, is filled with a lot of really great performances. Tom Hanks, Paul Newman again, Daniel Craig, even well before he became James Bond in a villainous role. But Jude Law, I think, is one of the great sort of overlooked villain performances of the last two decades. I mean, he is just so grimy and creepy in this movie, and it's just, you cringe every time you see him, yet you're sort of just drawn to just how much Law is doing on screen. I'm okay on the movie, but I love Jude Law's performance.
Okay. Steve, your next choice, Peter Sellers and Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah, I mean, it's three characters, three of the most memorable characters in film history. And again, like, going for something kind of obvious, but honestly, when you watch it, you just see how Sellers makes this one of the greatest comedies of all time by playing three really distinct characters, and they're all funny for different reasons. And some of them are over the top, some of them are really subtle and underdone, but they're all incredible. So yeah, I mean, this is it still feels like a very timely film too.
My favorite performance in that movie is George C. Scott.
Oh yeah, no, he's good.
Oh my God, he is so funny in it's amazing to me that he just didn't do comedy for the rest of his career.
Yeah,
after that, it's just a fun, funny performance. Okay, Eric, on your side, Willem Dafoe with the Florida Project.
Yeah, not the lead in this role, but he almost seems like he is, because just every time he's on screen trying to manage this little, rundown sort of flea bag motel that a lot of people, you know, stay at, who are, you know, renting by the, you know, the day and the week and whatnot, trying to make their ends meet. And there's a scene in the movie where he confronts this guy and buys him a soda.
Yeah.
And it's one of the most dynamic scenes I've seen in the last few years. I think one of Defoe's best performances.
Yep, I agree. Next one for Steve is Gary Oldman, Sid and Nancy.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things always fascinating about this is that Oldman kind of dismisses this performance as not that good, because it was one of his earliest leads. But man, it is like one of the most raw, committed, dangerous performances I think I've ever seen. And like what he's doing, and I just watched this film fairly recently. I forgot Roger Deakins was a cinematographer on it, and obviously Alex Cox is directing. But man, this is as playing the Sex Pistols bass player Sid Vicious. It felt like a movie that could cause trouble when I saw it. Honestly,
yeah, yeah. All right, interesting choice for your next one, Eric. Sean Connery in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Yeah, and I chose this one specifically specifically because when you go over the long history of Sean Connery's career, I don't think you've ever seen him play a role particularly like this one. I mean, he had just won the Oscar a couple years earlier for The Untouchables, and as great as he is in that movie, you can see a little bit of that character in future roles that Connery would play, and he'd play these tough guy roles later in his career, but never as so kind of affable and playing Indiana Jones's father in this movie. It's just a wonderfully transformative performance, I think, that I really think he should have been nominated for that year.
Okay. Your next choice, Steve. Oh my God, Daniel Day-Lewis in There Will Be Blood. One of the most towering performances in the history of film.
Oh, I think it's right up there with Orson Welles and Citizen Kane. Yeah. I mean, it's practically the same movie in a lot of ways. But no, I mean, as with just about every name on these lists, I could have picked any number of roles. There's certain actors I wanted to make sure I got on here. And this is the one that Daniel Plainview is like, he's an American icon, and for all the worst reasons for the most part. But he's sort of deeply unsettled, and he's just like this. He's got this chilling intensity, and man, I mean, it's just such a unique performance. And I remember the first time I saw it, I had a really hard time getting past the accent. Like, I was like, he's so clearly, I mean, I know it's not an original thought to say it sounds like John Huston, but it really does. It still does to me. I just got used to it, but it's almost like getting used to an act, like a foreign accent that you, it just takes a while. But man, once I got there, I was just so on board, and just this, he's like corruption embodied, and it's stunning and haunting and powerful, and it's going to be like, it's a performance that's going to be studied, I think, for generations.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Next one on your list, Eric, Leonardo DiCaprio in What's Eating Gilbert Grape. Great performance.
Yeah, and he was nominated for this, and you know, people want to go back to his pre-Titanic days and see where this unbelievable career sort of came from. This is the movie that really sort of launched him into, like, oh my God, this kid really can act. I mean, as good as he is in this Boy's Life, this was the role, and I chose it too just because I want more people to see that movie. It is such a quirky and weird and yet just kind of emotionally, a heartbreaking film about this, people who just want to break free of the lot that they've been dealt in life, and yet still trying to maintain the family unit and whatnot. It's just a beautiful movie.
Yeah, it is. Okay, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric and Steve, they're going to hang on, and we'll come back and we'll talk more with these guys about some of their favorite performances. 312-981-7200.
At the hotel, getting motel, treating me like
your hurry,
baby.
At
the hotel, getting motel,
treating me like
I'm for sale.
At the hotel, getting motel.
Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline studio here until 4. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday and it's a jokey time. And we are going to talk about historic events that actually didn't happen. We have 75 short jokes that anybody can remember. And the classic Carson that we always play, we're going to have a little Jonathan Winters. That'll be coming up at 2:30. The news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi are here. Let's get him back in. Eric?
Hello.
All right. Let's get through these a little bit quicker.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So let's see. Steve, you were next. Denzel Washington in Fences.
Yeah, I mean, the greatest stage performance I ever saw in my life was him playing Richard III at Shakespeare in the Park, and this is the closest thing I saw to that. The guy won a Tony for this role, and for very good reason. It's just a portrait of failure and a portrait of a father kind of pushing that failure onto his family, mm-hmm. and in particular his son. So it's devastating. But again, could have picked like three or four other parts for Denzel Washington too. So
let's get through your mail lists, mm-hmm. too, Steve. Next, Heath Ledger, Dark Knight.
They won an Oscar, man, and it's a bold choice for him to pick to play that, because other people played that character and played it really well, and his take on it, every tick, every weird gesture, line reading, so unpredictable, so good.
So I guess if you're going to play the Joker, you're going to win Oscars. I guess that's how it works.
I guess.
Tom Cruise, Born on the 4th of July. I'm glad you included this one because it's a great performance.
It's his best. I still think it's his best performance. Like, and he had been sort of going deeper and deeper into dramas at that point, and this just kind of hit. And I already knew Ron Kovic's story, and it just perfectly embodied it. And I'm just like so vulnerable, so tremendously moving.
Yeah. Philip Seymour Hoffman, Capote, great performance.
Yeah, and not necessarily one that makes you like Truman Capote very much.
That's the point.
Like it's captivating on that level, and it's really brave, I think. And he can be smooth as silk, but he's also like really uncomfortable in his own skin for a lot of reasons. So
this next one is one of my favorite performances ever in the history of anything. Dustin Hoffman in Tootsie. It's such a great.
And here's another one where we do a transformation, and again, it's not the reason that it's great. It's great because Hoffman plays his character, and he becomes a better actor by becoming a female, pretending to be a woman, but he also becomes a better human being, and I think that really comes through, and it's the funniest thing he had done since The Graduate, in my opinion. Yeah. So,
and then Forrest Whitaker, Ghost Dog.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I don't know how many people have seen it, but it's kind of set Forrest Whitaker on this path, and it injects him with just the right amount of like eccentricity and gravitas, and he's funny in it too at times. So, it's just such an unusual performance, and I think I've loved Forrest Whitaker ever since I saw this movie. So,
all right, it's back to Eric's list here for best male performances. Christian Bale in Empire of the Sun, one of the greatest child performances in the history of movies.
Yeah, one of the greatest child performances, one of the greatest debut performances ever. A movie that completely rests on his shoulders. Just a magnificent piece of work.
Yep. Jason Tremblay, you want to talk about great child performances, Wonder.
Yeah, and I've always said that Room is up there with the greatest child performances of all time. But, and Wonder, he had to do it under this layer of makeup. So he had to do a lot of acting with just his eyes. And, the scene in the movie where he discovers that he has more friends than he realizes, and he just breaks down.
Yep.
I think about that scene a lot, man.
Yep. Leslie Nielsen, Naked Gun.
Yeah, because comedy needs to be recognized.
Yeah.
And he played this part just so beautifully and so deadpan. That movie is a spoof, but I always refer to it as a screwball comedy.
Yep. John Candy, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Yeah, same token. Comedy is rarely recognized, and this is a movie that not just how funny he is in the movie, but how much we learn to empathize with that character, and it's such a marvelous transformation.
This next one is one of my favorite performances ever. Ryan Gosling in Blue Valentine. Both those performances are unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one of the most devastating.
Oh my God!
About the breakdown of a relationship, so true to form, and it's watching the ascent of the relationship and then the downfall. It just makes it all the more heartbreaking to watch.
Yeah. All right. Female performances. Let's start with Eric. We may as well because you just mentioned Ryan Gosling, Michelle Williams in My Week with Marilyn.
Yeah, the movie. People might think it's so, but her performance in the movie is just so hypnotic, and Michelle Williams is one of these actresses that I think we're going to regret not having given her 4 Oscars by now, but she may have that by the time her career is over.
Yeah, next one is one of my favorites, Anne Hathaway, Colossal.
Yeah, I think her best performance.
I think so. I agree.
I think she does a lot in that movie, and that final moment, man.
I know. Yep. Emma Watson in The Bling Ring.
Yeah, also not the star of the movie, but just an incredible comic performance from Emma Watson. A scene where she gives a statement to the police was still one of the funniest moments I saw on screen that year. And, the sign that she was growing up from the Harry Potter series.
Yep. Charlize Theron, young adult. She's so great in that movie.
Love this movie. So dark. Is not a likable character. Even by the end of the movie, you're not exactly sure where you stand with this character. But Charlize Theron doesn't often get credit for just the amount of range that she's been showing throughout her career.
Yeah. Jenny Slate, Obvious Child, a great performance.
Yeah, we mentioned this movie, I think, before. It's one to check out. And, Jenny Slate, she's certainly known for being a comedian, and she's definitely doing comedic work in this film. She's a great dramatic work as well.
Yeah. Florence Pugh, Lady M.
Yeah, Lady Macbeth. Macbeth, not based on the Shakespeare story, but, you know, Florence Pugh is now really, she had a really good year last year, and she's starting to really sort of come into her own. So, again, if you want to see where it all started, it started with this really sort of twisted period piece.
Olivia Wilde, Drinking Buddies. I love that movie.
Yeah, another Chicago set film, also with Jake Johnson in it, and directed by Joe Swanberg. We gave a lot of crap to Olivia Wilde last year for her work in Richard Jewell. I'd like to give a little bit back what I think is actually her best work to date.
Yep, Margot Robbie, I, Tonya.
Yeah, another story about a woman that we're not exactly sure how we're supposed to feel about her, but, you know, through Robbie's work, we begin to sort of empathize with her story a little bit more. It's also a very solid comic performance as well.
Yep, a terrific performance. And then Kathy Bates in Misery.
Yeah, I mean, you want to talk about a role that, you know, like, you know, who, people didn't really know who Kathy Bates was when Rob Reiner cast her. She was a stage actress, and she came on, and, you know, that movie was a hit, and she, you know, won the Oscar that year, and it's still one of the great villain performances ever.
Okay, Steve, your choices for female performance, Sigourney Weaver in Alien.
Yeah, over Aliens, only because I think this is a more pure acting role, and Ellen Ripley kind of isn't the star of the film until the end of the movie, and it's a great thing of just pushing someone to the foreground who wasn't really supposed to be there in life. But yeah, it's I think it's just a great acting performance.
Meryl Streep, Sophie's Choice.
I mean, the obvious choice for me. It's, you know, one of the greatest screen performances of the 20th century. End of story. And not just because of the accent.
Emily Watson, Breaking the Waves. Heartbreaking.
Oh, God. I mean, I don't know how else to... It's a tough movie. It's a tough movie to watch. It's an angry movie. But, I mean, talk about, like, throwing... I believe it was her first movie. So, yeah, it's if you haven't seen it, brace yourself.
Yeah. Pam Grier, Jackie Brown.
Who else could have played that? Like, what other actress could have played that specific character?
Yeah.
None. I mean, none. And it's not. I mean, she's just a survivor. And like, that's, I love seeing her and Robert Forster in that movie together.
Yeah. Nicole Kidman, To Die For. What a massively underrated movie.
Yeah, and not like her first film, but kind of the first that I think showed her range as like humor and just how daring she was and her prowess and just vibrant. And I think that was the first time we really got to see that.
Yep. Marianne Cotillard for La Vie en Rose. Great.
Again, like not her first film, but the one that kind of put her on the map. She won an Oscar for it, which I had completely forgotten, actually.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I even remember George Clooney said it was the performance of the decade in some interview that he did. So, yeah, it's a brilliant, tragic performance.
Yeah, Angela Bassett for What's Love Got to Do with It.
Speaking of which, yeah, I mean, this is another one that, like, and it's the smaller moments, I think. As good as and physical as she can be and how much she does an impression of Tina Turner, it's the sort of smaller, quieter moments. That moment of her asking for help from that hotel clerk is just unbelievable.
Yeah. Lupita Nyong'o for Us.
I mean, we've talked about her, you know, at the end of the year show, but this is like, you know, for shame on the Academy for missing the physicality and the psychologically exhausting performance of playing these two characters.
And man, one of my favorite performances ever, Toni Collette in Hereditary.
Yeah, just like grief-stricken mother and spouse, and like, I mean, it's a again another exhausting performance, but man, is she. Just embodies it, and I mean, we'd seen her for years, and yet who knew she still had something like this in her?
No, it's a great performance, one of my favorite performances ever. And then, speaking of amazing, Ellen Burstyn, Requiem for a Dream, a movie I've only seen once.
And most people probably have. But yeah, I mean, she had sort of gone without any kind of major roles, at least any gritty roles for a while. But then, yeah, in 2000, Aronofsky cast her in this performance. And it's so fully committed and devastating and without any vanity at all. And she just, and, you know, she got her 6th Oscar nomination for
She's one of my favorite actresses ever.
And she's still like a great beauty. In that movie, she is horrifying.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to kill Aronofsky at the end of that movie. I was just like, when it was over, I was like, I couldn't even get up. I was just so, I mean, I was like dry heaving, you know. It was just unbelievable. The last 15 minutes of that movie. Oh my God.
No, it's relentless.
It is completely. Well, these are all great choices. So what are we looking forward to? Is anything going to be streaming next week?
I'm sure there'll be a bunch of stuff streaming next week. And I think next week, since May will be coming around, there'll be a whole slew of new choices that'll be coming to a lot of the Amazon and Netflix and Hulu and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, there's a lot of time on people's hands.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, all right, you guys, stay safe, stay in, wash your hands.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
All right, guys, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll talk to you guys next week. That's Eric Childress and Steve Procopi, and we'll talk to them again next week for more movie talk right here on WGN.